This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on another special weather day across North Dakota. Isn't winter terrific?
Isn't it a beauty?
That's the voice of Bill Law. We're going to talk with Bill about his passion, music, and a particular kind of music today on our Main Street, because you're giving a lecture tomorrow at the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County at the Heritage Yumcombe Center in Moorhead about jazz, Bill.
I am. I was contacted by the folks at the Yumcombe Center, and they threw out a topic that I couldn't resist, one that I didn't know a lot about, but one that I couldn't resist, and it was, how did World War I influence the development of jazz?
Well, you're the assistant director of NDSU's Division of Performing Arts, and this lecture is tomorrow evening at 6 at the Yumcombe Center in Moorhead. General admission is $10. Members of the Historical Society get free admission, and you can find out more at hcscconline.org if you want to get tickets. I imagine you can get them at the door, too.
Correct.
What are you going to be telling people?
Well, this is, you know, this is a topic, as I've said, that I wasn't entirely familiar with. You know, this is a period of time. I'm a World War I history enthusiast, mm-hmm. and I'm a jazz musician and jazz history enthusiast. So I just thought, sure, I'll do it, you know, without knowing what it is that I'm going to do. So, you know, fortunately in this day and age, with Google and, you know, related search engines, virtually all of this music and or references to this music is readily available, which was a very interesting thing. The period of time that we're talking about, and I stretch my lecture in terms of a time frame from 1880 to 1919, uh-huh. time of great technological change, you know, the everything in American life and I imagine in the world. Changed conveniences like telephones and electricity.
And recorded music.
Recorded music. So they started making cylinder recordings. The original recordings were done on a tin kind of a material.
Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell, actually, right?
Right, exactly. So in the mid-1880s, they switched to a wax-based cylinder recording. 2 years later, Columbia Records. Now they're recording, so Columbia Records has a catalog of 10 pages long of listings of these cylinder recordings. So things started to happen. And, you know, with the advent of recorded music, you had a way of sharing that music with people.
Well, World War One, and the United States gets into it near the end, actually. We're
Correct.
Only in the fighting for several months. Nevertheless, there are terrible casualties. But this was before the Army was integrated.
Correct. And in this particular, one of the really interesting stories is about a guy named James Reese Europe. And he was a organizer, musician, a New York-based musician who was an organizer and created a couple of clubs. You're seeing my fingers are going up in parentheses, clubs that served as both essentially booking or talent agencies and performing organizations. And he organized these large groups of black musicians and presented formal concerts in places like Carnegie Hall, becoming the first person to present formal black music in a formal setting.
Wow.
When the war started, when America got into the war, he enlisted. He was a lieutenant. He came in as a soldier, was a machine gunner, but was quickly singled out to form a band in his black unit, which was the Harlem Hellfighters, the 369th.
Wow.
And because we weren't integrated, this unit was actually absorbed into a French army unit. So being in Europe, you know, and don't confuse Europe and James Reese Europe, being in Europe provided these black soldiers with a level of freedom and social integration that they wouldn't have at home. Reese forms this band. And there are a number of really fine recordings available online that still exist from just after the war because they hadn't recorded this stuff yet.
Uh-huh.
And it's really remarkable. These are brass bands. They're formal military-sounding bands. But the music is definitely of a ragtime nature. It's not quite jazz yet, but you can hear some of the sounds of jazz that occur.
Well, let's get a little sample of this because there are early recordings, and there's one of Jelly Roll Morton, a pretty
Correct.
Well-known jazz artist.
And this is a tune that he wrote in 1915. This was the first published jazz tune, and it's called Original Jelly Roll Blues.
I see so many cartoons running in my head right now.
Don't you?
Yeah.
Don't you? I mean, that's really a signature sound, and was, in many ways, that style of music was the soundtrack for the first third of the 20th century.
Yeah. I mean, Jelly Roll Morton is very well known now. And how well known was he then?
Well, he was, you know, in 1915, the first recording of jazz music didn't happen until 1917, but he was publishing sheet music with his original jazz music, and he's considered to be the first jazz composer. So he had some notoriety and became quite famous. Apparently, he was quite a character to deal with, but a very brilliant composer and player.
Well, and then, of course, we have all these fantastic musicians that come after him. You've got Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Ella
Joe
Fitzgerald.
Oliver. And, yeah.
So lots of very well-known names. Yet we are still a sharply segregated country.
We are a sharply segregated country. In 1917, the Navy shut down Storyville, which was the red light district in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And that was, of course, in terms of a collection of bars and brothels, gig territory for all of these New Orleans guys. So there was a great diaspora of New Orleans musicians to the north and into other places in the south. So their music spread as a result of the Navy shutting down their home turf. An influencer, not necessarily an intentional influencer, but created a great jazz scene in Chicago, for instance.
Well, the term jazz is itself sort of problematic, and of course the jazz age was coined by F. Scott Fitzgerald, a St. Paul guy who became a well-known writer after he died.
Sure, and the word jazz started to get tossed around prior to World War I, or in the beginning stages of World War I, before America was entering it. A lot of times you'd see it spelled J-A-S or J-A-S-S. You know, so the term jazz was starting to be used. It showed up in print, I think, in reference to baseball. And they were referring to speed and excitement of a baseball game. It was apparently a very jazzy experience. So the word got used in a couple of different ways and started to show up in print, and occasionally somebody would write something and call it a jazz song or a jazz piece. But Jelly Roll Morton is credited with being the first jazz composer.
Well, then you've got the flappers. You've got sort of the outrageous side of it, at least culturally. It was really
sure.
Pushing some boundaries, right?
Sure. By the time you hit, certainly 1919, 1920, there were some pretty fully formed jazz groups, and it spawned this whole culture that you're referring to, you know, the F. Scott Fitzgerald, Great Gatsby era, you know, flappers and excess, and, you know, I mean, things were good. This is post-war. The economy was good. People in America were experiencing a lifestyle at that point that was very different than the prior probably 30 years. Technology, again, was advancing. The first commercial radio broadcast happened in 1920. And of course, that allowed, you know, that grew quickly and allowed Americans to share music, you know, country music, jazz music, you know, formal music, politics, all, you know, all of that became part of the deal.
Well, you play bass.
I do play bass.
You've played classical, you've played rock, you've played jazz. And let's just pick apart the whole jazz genre here for a minute here, because there are different forms of jazz. There's Dixieland, there's improvisational.
Sure. Well, you know, I think at its core and its inception, the jazz that we're discussing right now is more what we all think of as Dixieland music. You know, it was a typical instrumentation where you'd have a front line of a clarinet, a trumpet, and a trombone player. Trumpet plays melody. The clarinet player noodles, you know, above that, and the trombone player plays counter melodies and sort of effects with the slide. And then some sort of a rhythm section that would be maybe piano, a bass instrument, which, you know, originally was a tuba, and some sort of drum. And the drum kit hadn't been invented yet, so drums were more of a sort of a, you know, a novelty sound, you know, in the group. And, of course, it was for rhythm. And, you know, it evolved from there. And I think when I'm talking about jazz, I'm talking about something that swings and where there's a lot of improvisation. The bands were probably playing a lot of head tunes, you know, not necessarily off a written sheet, which would differentiate it from maybe the same era ragtime music, which was mostly notated and presented in a more formal way, and then evolved from there. And, you know, within 10 more years, you start to run into the era of the big band, you know, which was a whole different sound, and jazz grew very rapidly, you know, into a, I think, a more formalized kind of music, and yet still retains those basic elements of swing and improvisation.
And these are white guys like Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller.
Yeah, some, or Duke Ellington and Count Basie.
Sure. I mean,
so there were black bands and white bands, but it was the music of the time. It was the popular music of the time. It was dance music and very exciting bands.
Well, I had the opportunity to see Duke Ellington just before he died in concert, and he was a showman. It was fun just to watch him.
Yeah, Duke was, in addition to being a fine composer, he was a showy pianist and a showy person. He was good on stage. You know, well, Duke was a character.
When you want to sit down and listen to some jazz, who do you like to listen to?
I'm a huge Duke Ellington fan.
Okay,
so
there we are.
New and old.
And, of course, he famously played in Fargo at the Crystal Ballroom a long time ago.
Right, in the early 1940s. We won't trick ourselves and put out a wrong date, but just before World War II, and there's a fine set of recordings available of that. That was the famous Blanton Webster Band, and one of the really best bands that Duke ever had played in Fargo.
And that ballroom was sort of at the foot of Island Park, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Before my time, sadly.
And mine as well. How did their work inform the present? I mean, now we've got, you know, the Beatles, you've got, and of course, all Maroon 5.
Right.
That kind of stuff.
Shades of the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Well, you know, everything builds on everything else. I mean, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and, you know, a great deal of what became rock music was, you know, came out of the jump band, big band tradition. The early rock bands, they all swung. You know, they all grew up listening to the same things that we're talking about. You know, they just rocked it up a little bit. Everything was faster. The beat was a little straighter, not as swingy. But it came from the same place, improvisation, you know, guitar solos, sax solos, you know, a lot of the, I think the mechanics of it, early rock and roll, are certainly very related to swing music.
Bill Law is giving a lecture at the Yemcombe Center in Moorhead about jazz and its connection to World War I, and it takes place at 6 o'clock tomorrow. It's a $10 admission charge. The Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County members get in free, so the price is right. It's inexpensive. But let's get back to this World War I thing, because this is the war to end all wars at the time. We have the Spanish flu devastating even millions more people around the world. And suddenly a group of people who had been, you know, minimized for culturally in this country for a very long time become prominent.
They do, and I think, you know, it's due to the opportunities that World War I brought them, you know, black soldiers being able to export their music to Western Europe, black soldiers being moved around the country and bringing their music to other places, that diaspora of musicians from New Orleans resulting in from the Navy shutting down their workplace, the red light district, and technological advances like recordings and commercial radio. And I think it made that music available. I think most Americans just had no idea. You know, at some point, they just had no idea that it existed or there was anything like it. And it was wildly popular in Europe, wildly popular in America. You know, it became the pop music of the day.
And you could argue it helped culturally open this country up because you were listening to something that someone else had created initially and you were really liking it.
Right. I think music has had a huge role in the integration of the United States.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Bill Law, Assistant Director of NDSU's Division of Performing Arts, and the man who's delivering a lecture at the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, the Umcombe Center in Moorhead on Tuesday evening. It's 6 o'clock. It's a $10 admission. And Bill, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll remember what's sometimes referred to as the day the music died. It didn't really, but Buddy Holly left this planet 60 years ago.
My funny Valentine.
There's nothing funny about forgetting to get something sweet for your sweetie.
Oops. Hey!
So don't come home empty-handed on February 14th, especially not if you bought something for yourself and then not share. Okay, maybe I did that a time or two. If you didn't get the chance to contribute during Prairie Public's Short and Sweet member drive,
it's not too late.
You have till Friday, February 8th, to get your orders in for those boxes of a decadent hand-rolled cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry. Oh, my mouth is watering already. Delivered to anyone, anywhere in the continental U.S.
Wowie, wow, wow, wow.
Maybe a grandparent or a kid in college could use a little truffle pick-me-up. And so could you. We'll even include a personalized message, maybe song lyrics or poetry if you like. Hey, try and get some NPR programming names in this love poem. All things considered, you're my favorite morning edition. Boxes start at just $10 a month. Go to prairiepublic.org or text the word support to 484848 and click on the link we send you. I know chocolate has the word late in it, but really, don't be late. It's not chocolate.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. 60 years ago yesterday, one of the founding fathers of rock and roll was on his way to a concert in Moorhead when he was killed in a plane crash. Buddy Holly was only 22 years old when he died, along with Mexican-American star Ritchie Valens and J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson. The tragedy is often referred to as the day the music died. In a report that aired on NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday, Betsy Blaney of Texas Tech Public Media spoke with Holly's high school classmates from Lubbock, Texas, who recalled the years before his rise to fame.
In the early 1950s, Lubbock High student Betty Dotz was into music, classical piano. She sang with Buddy Holly in the school choir and knew he had grander ambitions. She was skeptical.
When I heard him play, I thought, oh my goodness, that's not very good music.
One minute of your sweet kiss, then my heart was all miss. It's love, baby, it's love.
George Nelson, another Lubbock High choir member, felt differently. Today he's an attorney, but in his teen years, Nelson also enjoyed songwriting.
Never had anywhere near the talent that Buddy had. He was just innately endowed with it, and he could play.
In 1953, he and Holly faced off in a song contest. Nelson's tune, Someday You'll Pay, won.
the only thing that I've got in my life that I could brag about musically.
At the time, rock and roll was starting to shake up the nation, but Holly wasn't there yet.
He sang strictly country music back then, country western music.
That's Larry Byers, a former DJ in Lubbock. He heard Holly's early performances live on local radio and at venues around town.
Until he saw Elvis Presley and decided that maybe he ought to change his style a little bit.
Well, if you love me, honey, will you let me know? If you really let me, never let me go. Love me, love me, love me. Well, I'm hoping you did.
Rock and roll got an especially cold reception in Lubbock. George Nelson remembers preachers regularly smashing vinyl records or using cars to crush them.
The real ultra-conservative people thought the young people were going to hell in a handbasket.
Local teenagers who wanted to listen to rock and roll would circle their cars out in cotton fields, blast the radio, and dance.
Oh, let's go now, man, go.
After high school, Holly threw himself into pursuing a music career, but his success was cut short in 1959. Holly was just 22 when he was killed in a plane crash in Iowa, along with two other up-and-coming musicians, Richie Valens and J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson. Holly's old classmate, Betty Dots, says his hometown was slow to realize who they'd lost.
Certainly he put Lubbock on the map, places all around the world. And Lubbock, it took them a long time to finally step up and recognize, because it's really outstanding what he did. That doesn't happen every day.
It would be almost 20 years when the 1978 movie The Buddy Holly Story was released before the city came around. Today, Holly has a park with a bronze statue of him and a street and a museum named after him. And the Crossroads of Music Archive at Texas Tech University houses the research of the late music historian Bill Griggs, who assembled a thorough accounting of Buddy Holly's life, every day of it.
May 31st, 1956, Thursday. A John Wayne movie titled The Searchers opened at the State Theater.
Curtis Peoples, an archivist, reads from Buddy Holly day by day.
Buddy and Jerry Allison went to see it. The movie cost them 65 cents each. During the movie, John Wayne would mutter, "That'll be the day," each time he was disgruntled about something.
That'll be the day.
Buddy and Jerry decided to write a song later that evening. By now, you know what the title was.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry.
Lubbock is still making up for lost time. Construction is underway on the Buddy Holly Hall of Performing Arts and Sciences in the city's Arts District. It's slated for completion next year. Not a bad legacy for a guy whose classmates didn't think he'd amount to much musically. For NPR News, I'm Betsy Blaney in Lubbock, Texas.
The 1959 concert Holly and Valens and Richardson were flying to was billed as the Winter Dance Party at the Moorhead Armory. And a 15-year-old Fargo High School student named Robert Valleen had a ticket. However, that night he wasn't in the audience. He was drafted to perform on stage, and that launched his career as rock and roll star Bobby V.
Rubber ball, I come bouncing back to you. Rubber ball, I come bouncing back to you.
Many years later, after fighting Alzheimer's disease, Bobby V passed away in October 2016. But his music remains, and this Saturday, a tribute concert remembering Bobby V will take place at the Fargo Theater, featuring his sons Tommy and Jeff and their cousin Matt, and Matt's son, Bennett. Coming up, we'll learn about prebiotics, a new North Dakota business called Food First. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota Senate defeated a bill to raise the state's gas tax by 4 cents. The current gas tax in North Dakota is 23 cents. The bill would raise the tax to 27 cents and would generate an additional $59 million every biennium. The bill came to the Senate on a do-not-pass recommendation. District 4 Senator Jordan Kanyanen says the Department of Transportation did not recommend this action and that other bills before the legislature do more to address additional revenue for North Dakota's transportation infrastructure. But some senators believe the issue deserved another look. District 41 Senator Kyle Davison says his constituents would gladly pay an increased gas tax.
This is not an unreasonable tax. I walked around this weekend. My wife was so tired of walking with me. It was the grocery store, the restaurant, the wellness center. What do you think about increasing the gas tax 4 cents? There wasn't one constituent that I talked to that said, don't you dare do that. They said, that sounds like a good idea. I'd like better roads. And then they'd go ahead and they'd tell me which road they want me to fix first.
The bill failed on a vote of 18 to 24. Senate Minority Leader Joan Heckerman says the proposal to move the women's prison from New England to the Missouri River Correctional Center in Bismarck came as a surprise to many legislators.
You know, there was no interim study. There was no discussion on whether this should come forward. It was the governor's initiative.
The plan calls for the MRCC residents to move to Jamestown. Governor Burgum proposes converting the existing Jamestown State Hospital into a prison facility and building a new state hospital there. Heckerman says there's been talk of making the proposal into a study, putting it off for a couple of years. She says that would answer some concerns.
What the cost would actually be. What are we going to have to do to retrofit the Missouri River Correctional Facility and the Jamestown facility? Also, the building of the state hospital is in there, joined in with that somehow. And all those take money. And again, it's where the appropriations feel that the best use of those dollars will be.
The proposal is still in committee. And Minnesota lawmakers are working on a measure to allow the state to join 8 other states in legalizing sports betting. But the head of the state's Indian Gaming Association has reportedly told Governor Walz and legislative leaders that the tribes don't want sports betting in their casinos and will oppose efforts to legalize it. Minnesota State Senator Roger Chamberlain, who's crafting a bill, says sports betting will provide opportunities for the tribes.
I hope they're willing to talk and negotiate to come to a solution because it'll be good for them. And we want to protect their interests. We're not interested in harming their economic future.
Chamberlain says sports betting is already prevalent in the state.
And there's no reason to deny the citizens the opportunity to do it. There are a lot of sports bettors in the state of Minnesota doing it illegally. So might as well legalize it, get it regulated, protect it, structure it, and let people have fun, do it in a safe manner, and make some money.
Chamberlain says there are many issues to iron out, including betting via mobile app. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fargo, featuring a Valentine's package February 14th through the 16th that includes a guest room, 4-course dinner for two, and wine or a sparkling cider delivered to your room. 701-232-7363 or RadissonFargo.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Bob Thornburg and Jordan Thornburg. They're both associated with Food First, which is an entrepreneurial effort to create what's called a prebiotic food supplement or food product. And Bob, you're the president and CEO of this organization, so lay it out for us quickly here.
Prebiotics, it's kind of a new area where people are very familiar with probiotics. Prebiotics are the food for probiotics, the fiber in our diet. The probiotic bacteria that you have in your gut need prebiotic fibers to survive. And at Food First, we've developed a fermented blend of wheat, flax, oats, and barley malt, and we grow yeast on that to create a multi-prebiotic fiber and protein source called probiotine.
So is probiotine sort of everything then, or is this, do you need to take a probiotic after that?
Well, it doesn't hurt to take a probiotic, but it's not necessary. You don't have to take a probiotic in order to use our prebiotic product.
Bob, we talked to you some time ago, 4 years ago as a matter of fact, about your animal feed supplements. What got you into the people food business?
Our animal food customers got us into the people food. They were having such good results, especially the horse owners, and better hoof quality and better hair coat and better everything. And they just kept saying, boy, if it's that good for my horses, you know, make some for me. And, you know, we were reluctant for quite a while, but ultimately decided we should do that. And that's been the evolution of it. It grew from that kind of close experiences that people were having, and now feeding our own microbial population just like we were feeding animal microbial populations. It's just as important for people, and so that's where we are now.
Jordan, you're one of several family members involved in Bob Dad's business. Who else is involved in this?
My oldest sister, Lace, is kind of spearheading this Kickstarter project for us.
As far as on the feed side, my brother Eric is involved with Sweet Pro and Equipride, especially on the promotional side of things. Ashley has been great on the promotional end, freelance stuff here and there. And even my sister Candace has helped out making bars here.
Well, you wouldn't be surprised that Ashley brought it to our attention, because this is Ashley Thornburg we're talking about, who's a significant contributor to Main Street, sits in as the host on many occasions. Why is your company called Food First, Bob?
We want to call attention to food as your first medicine. Food first, pharma second. And if you take better care of your body and have a proper diet, it really can prevent a lot of problems that you otherwise need medication for.
I neglected to mention where you are speaking from, which is where you produce all of these products. Tell us about your community, Bob.
Yeah, we're in Walhalla, North Dakota, right on the Canadian border, probably 3 miles from Canada, 185 miles from Fargo. So it's a town of a bustling, probably 900 people. We have no stop signs and no franchise anythings in town.
Your premier Food First product uses a berry from Saskatoon. Tell us about this particular berry, the Saskatoon berry.
Well, the Saskatoon berry has been around, and a lot of people are familiar with it during the harvest because they make the pies in the Canadian prairies, and in the U.S. sometimes it was called Juneberry or in some areas service berry. But the Saskatoon berry is the main name, and it's on a bush that's kind of uniquely suited for this part of the world. But it's very high nutritional quality, high antioxidant levels. It's better than blueberry even. And so we kind of see it as, a new superfruit, but it has needed, more than just the fresh berry approach, because that's so difficult. And so we've taken to being able to process it, carefully dry it, and put it in a powder form so that it can be used year-round. And so now we've incorporated it into our latest of the microbiome bars.
Jordan, when I look at the back of the Sunny Saskatoon Berry Sample microbiome bar, I see lots of ingredients. So tell us about the kind of facility, the equipment you need to make a product like this, and, mixing it all up.
Well, all the ingredients, we mix with, it almost looks like a giant KitchenAid mixer, a big 6-foot-tall stand-up Hobart mixer. We could mix about 80 quarts at a time, or even up to 140 quarts. And so we mix the dry ingredients with the wet, the liquid binder ingredients that we've heated up separately. So we combine those, the liquid and the dry, and then we feed it into a machine, a tabletop machine, actually, that's fairly compact and a nice size for us, but it just spits out the bars one by one, and it's pretty neat to watch them come out.
Well, and, how many bars does one batch make?
We can get about a little over 2,000 bars in a day. That's including the double two-piece bar, so 4,000 pieces.
Now, this microbiome bar I'm looking at says sample on it. So the Sunny Saskatoon Berry is a sample product right now. And what does that mean? You're introducing it to people, I assume.
We're introducing it as the Sunny Saskatoon Berry because of the sunflower butter and then the Saskatoon Berry's prominence in it as a high antioxidant superfruit. And then the probiotine is the prebiotic component that we're basic in here as the probiotine. But it kind of completes our package of development for the microbiome bar. And we thought we would try a Kickstarter campaign. It's very new for me. I didn't know much about it, and I guess everybody under 40 knows exactly what Kickstarter is. I needed a lot of explanation, however.
So what's the goal of the campaign?
Well, the goal right now, we We set a dollar amount, and we picked $7,500 as the target to help us finish this product and be able to import the Saskatoon product into the United States better so that we can continue this. But five or so categories people can participate in. It's kind of a crowdfunding for startups and for new projects. And so we're hoping to oversubscribe it, and people will get, once we're completed with it, then they'll get to get product as a thank you and at a discounted amount and that type of thing. So, Kickstarter is still a little new for me. Jordan probably can explain it better than I can.
Jordan, is there any way you can get the bar without doing the Kickstarter? Is it available in a store somewhere or at your plant?
Yeah, it's on Amazon and our own website, probiotine.com, as well as a few local retailers around here. But those two websites I mentioned were probably the easiest way to find it.
So how much does it cost?
Right now, the price is $34.95 for a dozen pack, and then that's free shipping if you get it over the Internet on Amazon or on our website, too. For us, it makes no difference if it's Food First or Amazon. Stores are starting to pick it up in the northeastern part of North Dakota. Generally speaking, the bars are pretty comparable to the Kind bars or Clif bars and that type of thing on a per gram basis. It's just that we're pretty dense in the, in the size. So, you're getting two bars in a package right now. And in the future, we think we'll have a single pack offering as well.
How hard is it to market a new health food product like this? That would seem to be a crowded market.
Well, that's a good question. It is what we're in the process of finding out. We feel that because we're unique with the prebiotic side of it, that we bring something new to the table, and in fact, we're calling it a gut health bar and creating a new category. As such, there's a lot of energy bars or protein bars or fiber bars and, that type of thing. This one is presented as a gut health bar, especially because of that prebiotic fiber component. So we think we'll have an advantage in that regard because there's so much greater awareness and growing awareness of the importance of good gut health. And so people are kind of looking to it. They're better understanding prebiotics. So we think we're at the right time with the right type product, but still going to be a challenge to get that word out.
Well, what about the regulatory environment for a product like this? What sort of hoops do you have to jump through?
Well, most of the hoops that we are jumping through are facility related. We have SQF, the Safe Quality Food Certification Level 2, that's more stringent than what FDA requires. And so we're kind of going out of our way to be sure that we have a very safe production facility. We don't present it as a medicine because it's not a medicine, it's food. And so we don't have some of those kinds of regulatory issues that we would have to worry about. And so it's easier in that regard. The fact that it works so well, people convey almost medicinal qualities to it, but it's just food and, consistent with our food first kind of orientation.
Well, what kind of study do you do on a product like this? Is it mostly anecdotal evidence or is there some sort of objective analysis that is placed on this?
Well, it's anecdotal in the beginning because that's all we have, but we've had years worth of, both research work and the animal side that we could demonstrate better utilization of the feed, better fertility in animals, better hoof quality as, regarded by farriers and that type of thing. And so that better ability to use nutrients is the real key. And on the human side, people are finding that, it almost can help in weight loss because it fills them up better and they they get all those nutrients, you know, better used, and so they don't feel as hungry. So those kinds of things, I think in the future we will be working to have some formal studies. We do know that some work has been done with Step One Foods out of Minneapolis with Saskatoonberry included in their foods, and they've done research where it reduced cholesterol based on work at the Mayo Clinic and the University of Manitoba. And that organization is owned by a cardiologist who's really oriented to can they do things without statin drugs. And so here again, you know, they're thinking, you know, better food, fewer meds. And so this is a very similar kind of orientation. We just don't have the formal studies yet ourselves.
Jordan, you're the production manager. We talked a bit about how you put the bar together here. Food products are occasionally recalled. Does a business like yours require any sort of liability insurance for the product?
Well, we take special precautions in order to keep track of any recall issues that we may have. We haven't had to deal with them other than like mock recalls that we have to have as part of our SQF certification. We keep track of all the lot numbers of ingredients that we receive. We hold on to, you know, phone numbers and all that for customers who have purchased our products so that we can be ready in case anything were to happen.
The Sunny Saskatoon Microbiome Bar is your sample right now. It's your Kickstarter sample. There are some other flavors in the works, aren't there?
Yes. In fact, there's three that are completed, and the Sunny Saskatoon is the final version that we've been waiting to complete the whole package. But we started with one we call Peanutty Cranberry, and then a Razz Apple Almond. And then one that looks like it's kind of jumping to the forefront for popularity called the Choco Cherry. And so it's got a chocolate and a cherry mix. Consistent with all of them is the same amount of probiotin as the, you know, that prebiotic fiber component.
Now, I'm picturing the Thornburg sitting around a table reaching for piles of various microbiome bars. How do you make the decision on flavors?
Well, it's a good question. I know, in fact, my daughter Candace, you know, she had identified that peanut butter and the probiotin kind of blended together well early on, and so that was part of the influence on picking a Peanutty Cranberry, you know, first variation, and then others in the company, you know, pressed for the apple chunks in it. So the raspberry apple almond one kind of emerged that way. And being close to the border, of course, I was real interested in that Saskatoon berry and knowing that it's so nutritious and everything. So that I was kind of gearing for that. But before we could do the Saskatoon berry bar, Peggy Longtine in our office developed the chocolate cherry one. So it kind of comes, you know, from all sides in a way, but the result has been pretty good.
Bob, when we spoke 4 years ago, we were talking about probiotin, and it was picked up in a book, this baker, James Beard Award-winning baker, Peter Reinhardt, and so obviously you've got some important people interested in this product. Is there a future for it beyond these bars we're talking about?
Well, we think very definitely, and there's work being done, in fact, as we speak, to be putting it into both muffins and breads at a fairly significant retailer. We'll see how that goes. But there, again, the same interest is bolstering the fiber content, bolstering the, you know, the nutritional characteristic of that bread. And it turns out it boosts the flavor profile as well with kind of a sourdough kind of emphasis. So we think that's going to be the longer-term market to break into, but maybe ultimately the largest of all.
Well, I assume that, you know, major companies like General Mills, you know, are probably looking into how to enhance their product line. Is probiotene something that is a, is this a competitive position you're in?
Well, we think we'll be very competitive. There's really nobody doing it quite like this. There's been the occasional prebiotic out there, just a single version, like fructooligosaccharide.
Wow.
But your body, you know, your body, those microbes need more than just one. So we're there with a multi prebiotic. So we have the what they call the FOS, as I just mentioned. But then, you know, it gets pretty long, arabinoxylan oligosaccharide, which gets real technical, but it's just part of what's there in nature. And it's part of that fiber that feeds the probiotic organisms better. And so a mix of those, you know, feeds your thousand different strains of probiotics just a little better and ultimately, we think, more efficiently that way.
Jordan, how many microbiome bars do you eat a day?
That's a good question. You know, especially the peanutty cranberry one, that reminds me of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, so that one goes well as a breakfast. But the nice thing is that you know, with there are two pieces and they're fairly large, you know, at 40 grams a piece, so 80 grams total. So what we hear a lot of people do is they'll eat one in the morning and then one maybe a few hours or just in the afternoon. So it can kind of break it up a little bit.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting venture, and obviously a family that is tied to its success as well. So we thank the Thornbergs for spending some time with us on Main Street, just as we always thank Ashley for spending some time with us during the day. Bob Thornburg is the president and CEO of Harvest Fuel, Sweet Pro Feeds, and Food First. We've been talking about Food First here, and Jordan Thornburg is the production manager of Food First. Thank you both for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
With a song in my heart for you.
All you need is love and great music. The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus presents Valentine's Sweets for the Sweet on Thursday, February 14th at 7 p.m. at the Bavendick State Room at Bismarck State College. Along with performances of favorite love songs, the event will feature a Valentine dinner, private serenades, and wine tasting by Willikers. Tickets must be purchased in advance and are available at Eckroth Music, The Barber's Wife, or online at bismanchorus.com. More information at 701-400-7774.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 4th. About 8 miles north of Bismarck is a bluff on which the Mandan Indians once had a thriving village called Double Ditch Village, which is designated as a significant historic site. Double Ditch overlooks the Missouri River. It was made up of at least 150 earth lodges that used a sturdy architectural system unique to the Mandan, Hidatsas, and Arikaras. These lodges were dome-shaped, made of logs and earth that could house families of 8 to 20 people. The size of an earth lodge was usually decided by the men, but the women were the primary builders. Several early explorers recorded their relief at being able to stay in a warm earth lodge during their winter travels. The first stage in the construction was a circular wooden framework. It was then covered with layers of willow branches, grass, and finally earth. One earth lodge alone could use up to 150 trees harvested from the banks of the Missouri. Within the villages, the lodges were placed close together and varied from 20 to 65 feet in diameter. Double Ditch appears to have been used between the years of 1500 and 1781, and now all that remains are circular depressions in the ground. Surrounding the entire site, one can also see two fortification ditches, as well as ancient trash heaps called midden mounds. The Mandans had a highly organized and productive culture based on farming and bison hunting. Their oral history indicates that Double Ditch was one of 7 to 9 interrelated villages near the mouth of the Heart River. The tribe once numbered around 10,000, but a smallpox epidemic decimated the tribes, and the few Mandans who escaped death joined the Hidatsa and Arikaraa survivors to establish new villages upriver. Therefore, the abandoned villages represent the last of the purely Mandan sites in existence. The double ditches, for which the village is named, were formed when the village was surrounded by a palisade or fortification wall, similar to those surrounding early military posts. Magnetic analysis has revealed a second set of ditches further out, which indicates the village was at one time much bigger. Ray Wood, an anthropologist from the University of Missouri, called the Double Ditch one of the country's most fascinating archaeological sites. "You can't walk over this site without being inspired," he said. "There's nothing else like it along the Missouri River or any other river in the country. It tells us a lot about Mandan history and prehistory." Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Mary Helm. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The categories of left and right divide our world.
Exit left.
All the left-handed people.
Left-wing extremism.
A right-wing group.
Far right.
Exit right.
These categories also apply to our brains. How the right and left hemispheres shape our view of the world. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Just a little time left in our show to thank those of you who took part in our short and sweet membership drive. Some of you are getting these wonderful cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry, or you're sending them to somebody because you pledged your sustaining support to Prairie Public, and we thank you for doing that. Those of you out there who are still interested in some cocoa truffles, and, you know, we do have Valentine's Day coming up until February 8th, you can get those truffles, and you can help support the public radio you're listening to right now. And at Main Street, we deeply appreciate that. You can just give us a call at 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org, or you can text SUPPORT to 484848, then follow the link we send you. And for those of you who have, again, our thanks. Coming up on Main Street on Tuesday, a new exhibit at the North Dakota Museum of Art is called The Inventor, Photos by Elmer O. Thompson and Reflection on His Life, 1890 to 1893. Ken Smith, president of the Ellendale Historical Society and a PhD candidate, will join us to talk about the work. And Tim Fechner is the 2019 North Dakota Pinball Champion. In March, he'll represent the state at the National Pinball Championship in Las Vegas, so we'll hear from him as well. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.